The ceremonial magic of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn is among the most widely practiced of all magical systems today. Yet what does it mean? Because not a lot of people know about it. In a moment, John Michael Greer back with us on Coast to Coast, and we'll talk about that. Don't go away. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, John Michael Greer back with us, last on with us back around almost 6 years ago. He's the author of 20-plus books in the field of alternative spirituality and studies, including the award-winning The New Encyclopedia of the Occult, The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, and Secrets of the Lost Symbol. He is also the author of a popular weekly blog as well. And his blog spot can be linked at coasttocoastam.com. John, welcome back. How have you been?
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back.
It's been a long time.
Really, really? It has been a while, hasn't it?
Jeez. I mean, you've been working away. I know that.
Yeah.
And enjoying yourself?
Oh, more or less, yeah. Well, to the extent that I've had time between writing books, writing blog posts, and all that kind of stuff.
How many are you up to now? 20-plus, right?
Right now, counting the ones that are in press and haven't quite hit yet, 50.
50 books now?
50 books, yeah.
Good for you.
Okay.
Good for you. And generally on the very supernatural, the strange, the spiritual, same kind of genre, I guess, right?
I always write. I write about the things that cause people's hackles to go up. I write about strange stuff. That's always been the stuff that interests me.
Well, that's good. Let's talk about this one that we've got here, Circles of Power, an introduction to Hermetic magic. What is Hermetic magic, first of all?
Okay. Basically, complicated story here. It's a tradition that got going during the Renaissance, and basically, what happened was a bunch of documents from Egypt, originally from ancient Egypt, but they were rewritten in Greek after Alexander the Great conquered Egypt back in the 4th century. And these were the Hermetic documents, the Hermetic essays, because they were credited to Hermes Trismegistus, the great magician and god of magic. They probably weren't written by him, of course. Nobody knows who wrote them, but it was commonplace in those days to take a famous name and slap it on a book like that. So there's one surviving copy that ended up in a library in Byzantium, and then it got picked up after the Byzantine Empire fell to the Turks. It got picked up by a bunch of basically collectors, taken to Italy, and it got handed over to Marsilio Ficino, who was a translator, one of the really hot geniuses of the time, who translated this thing into Latin, which was the common language of scholarship, and all of a sudden everybody had access to some of these basic acids, these basic concepts out of ancient Egyptian magical wisdom. So, of course, Europe went ape over it. Of course, there was a lot of grumbling from the church. You've got to expect that. There were a lot of grumbling from rationalists. You've got to expect that too. But from that, because these were the supposed writings of Hermes Trismegistus, that whole current took the name of the Hermetic tradition. And it has nothing to do with hermits, by the way. I have yet to meet anyone who's
or hermetically sealed, right?
Or hermetic. Well, actually, hermetic. That's a funny one, because hermetically sealed, the other batch of stuff that was attributed to Hermes Trismegistus was about alchemy. And the alchemists were the first people who figured out how to make an airtight seal. And so that's where they got the idea of hermetically sealed. It was sealed according to this alchemical process. So, but yeah, that has nothing to do with hermetic magic. And this tradition went from the Renaissance straight into the early modern world with the triumph of rationalism, the scientific revolution. Of course, it was driven underground into a variety of secret societies and lodges and things like that, and it remains a living tradition today.
Now, let's talk about magic in general, John.
Mm-hmm.
What is magic, as far as you're concerned?
Okay.
I mean, I think of David Copperfield and people like that. Is that magic?
Rabbits and hats, yeah. Well, you know, actual practitioners of real magic tend to think of the stage magic is fun, okay? But it has as much to do with real magic as a Harlequin romance has to do with a real relationship, okay? It's just, you know, it's the movie stuff. It's the fancy stuff that's faking the supernatural. Magic was defined very usefully by Dion Fortune, who was one of the great 20th century practitioners, as the art and science of causing change in consciousness in accordance with will. Now, When you say that, everyone thinks, oh, you mean just changing my consciousness. You're changing your mind, it's psychology, da da da. Notice what isn't being said here. Changing whose consciousness? You can change your own consciousness. You can change other people's consciousness. You can change a lot of different consciousness on a lot of different levels using the methods and techniques of magic. But it's all about consciousness. It all works through consciousness, through the mind, through concepts, visualizations, images, symbolism, and things related to that.
Now, when we talk about magic in general, what type of people are performing the magic? What are they called? The magicians?
Well, it depends on one of the things you'll have to get used to in dealing with all the stuff in the occult world. It's like the old joke about, you know, you ask a question of three rabbis, you get at least five answers. It's worse than that in the magical field. Some people who practice magic like to call themselves mages. That's a very old, very traditional term. You'll find occultists used sometimes. You'll find all kinds of terms. Of course, the people who don't like magic have terms of their own, like devil worshiper, which is nonsense, but it's, of course, very lucrative nonsense if you're in that business. But as for who gets into magic, mostly it's people who look at the options that are presented to them by our modern society. On the one hand, you have dogmatic rationalism saying, we know what the truth is, and you're just a lump of meat, and that's all there is to it. Now hand us money. Or you get the dogmatic religious types saying, we know what the truth is, you have to do what our holy book says, even though it contradicts the other 57 holy books out there, now give us money. In magic, practitioners of magic aren't really into the handing over money to people who claim to have truth.
Right.
It's just not really something we're into.
What are they trying to do, these practitioners? What's their goal?
Okay. Again, three mages get five answers. Most generally, though, the idea, first of all, obviously, is to get some level of mastery over the powers and capacities of magic, to learn what you're doing, to be able to apply it. To some extent, you can apply it just in improving your life, making your life work better, and so on. But there's very much this sense that there is something deeper going on here. There's a capacity to tap into hidden currents of consciousness within the universe. This is what's called the great work, the attainment of that ability to reach into the heart of the world, to tap into those currents of power, to make yourself one with them. I'm going to start sounding like Obi-Wan Kenobi here, you know. A Jedi must feel at one with the Force.
You may be right.
George Lucas borrowed some very useful stuff in those early movies.
Well, he was spot on. Yeah, he understood. Well, I don't know who he consulted with, but he understood it.
He got some good stuff. The thing is, the first movie, quote, episode 4, unquote, is actually really good when it comes to magic because it doesn't have anybody doing levitation or any of that, any of the fancy CGI. What does Obi-Wan do in the Star Wars, you know, A New Hope, okay? He clouds the minds, you know. These aren't the droids you're looking for. And the stormtrooper just goes, these aren't the droids we're looking for. He sneaks into the Death Star, and nobody sees him. He clouds himself, clouds their minds, controls their consciousness. He has influence over them. Mm-hmm. You know. Then finally, he passes into a different state of being when he's cut down by Darth Vader, and things proceed from there. But there's actually nothing in that first Star Wars movie, the original one, that contradicts things that can actually be done by magic. Once you get into the other ones, you start getting levitation, you start getting, you know, lightning bolts from fingertips. That's nonsense.
Now, this work, Circles of Power, you are diving deep into higher magic.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what is higher magic compared to other kinds of magic?
Okay. Actually, it's the usual term is high magic.
Okay.
High magic, the distinction between high magic and practical magic or folk magic, or there are various other terms for it, is a matter of what your goal is. If you're just doing it to try to make your life easier, then which is perfectly valid, of course, if that's what you want to do, that's what you need. That's practical magic, and that's fine. Lots of people do that. There are lots of different ways to do that. If you're trying to tap into the heart of things, as I mentioned earlier, you're trying to achieve the great work and become that, you know, that the kind of first become a master of the Force, then you're doing high magic. that requires it's high magic in this, you know, the same sense we speak of higher mathematics or things like that. It's a lot more demanding. It requires a lot more out of you. If you're going to practice high magic, it's not a part-time affair. You're doing it all the time.
And what are you trying to accomplish with high magic?
Again, you're trying to reach. There's that perception that I mentioned, that there is a way to relate to the currents of power and consciousness in the universe that goes beyond what we ordinarily achieve, that we can accomplish this great work, tap into those powers, and actually participate in the process that brings the universe into being. It sounds very mystical, I know.
True.
But ultimately you're left with that kind of language when you're trying to deal with things like this. It is mystical. It is a matter of going beyond what we ordinarily think of as human. Now, most occultists will say, well, yeah, this is actually what the heart of being human is, but we don't know that. We don't experience that on a day-to-day basis. We normally just kind of stumble along with our lives. We go to work, we come home, we turn on the television and turn into couch potatoes. There's more to life than that. There's a lot more to life than that. And magic is one of the ways to get there.
With magic, are you, doing spells and things like that?
Not in the Harry Potter sense, okay?
Right.
The Harry Potter movies are really bad when it comes to magic. You know, you have Harry picks up a wand with a phoenix feather in it, get one of those, by the way, and goes, you know, hocus pocus.
But they look so cool.
Bad Latin. And CGI takes off. Ritual is an important tool. Now, Ross Nichols, who was another very important occultist in the 20th century, used to say that ritual is poetry in the world of action. Meaning that just the way that a well-written poem can really focus your awareness on something, you just, wow, I didn't think of the world that way. Ritual does the same thing. Ritual is a way of symbolic drama. It's a way of focusing your mind on certain things. You know, let's say you want to do a working, let's say, just do one of the obvious things, love working, okay? Your relationships suck. You're having a really bad time. Now, there are two ways you can deal with that. You can try to pressure other people into changing themselves, in which case it's not going to do very well. That's the usual thing. Or you can say, okay, what am I doing? What am I doing wrong? How am I messing up my relationships? And you can try to change that by using ritual means, by using symbolism, by using all these kind of things to get into the deep levels of the mind. One way to think about magic, in fact, is that it's kind of, you know, getting into the programming. You're not just working on the surface, you're actually getting into the program of the mind and saying, oh, that's what's wrong, tweak, and make it work.
Now, that sounds like magic is being used for the good. Can it also be used for the bad?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are people who are asinine enough to do destructive magic, quote, black magic, unquote.
And they can get away with it, right?
Well, for a while. It always blows up in their faces.
That's a good thing, I guess.
There's a principle that I like to call the raspberry jam principle. Now, back when you were a kid, if you ever put raspberry jam onto a piece of bread, you got some on your own fingers, right?
That's right. And your face.
That's the nature of raspberry jam. Magical energies are the same way. If you want to, build up a big head of nasty energy, you want to zot someone, okay, you're going to, the energies that you're trying to direct into that other person's life are going through you, and they stick. And it doesn't matter how much you do to try to chase them off. You're attuning yourself to these destructive energies, and they're going to manifest in your life just as they manifest in the other person's life. You know, people say, well, that's just morality. It's not morality. It's like saying, washing your hands is a necessary thing. And, it's just the way magic works. Similarly, of course, if you're doing mostly positive energy, if you're doing positive working, that's going to manifest in your life, too.
Would that be called good magic or high magic?
Your practitioner of high magic learns very quickly, the easy way or the hard way, take your pick, that you want to do mostly good magic. In fact, you want to do entirely good magic, and if you ever get into a situation where you're going, oh, I want to zot that person, you stop and say, okay, why? What am I doing that's making me so brittle or so vulnerable that this person's getting to me like that? And then you use magic to change that.
Is magic almost like a religion?
Some people may treat it that way. Some people have their magic and then they have their religion. It's the problem is that so many people have such different ideas about what a religion is. To some extent, in magic, you're not necessarily depending on outside powers. You're not, you know, depending on God or a goddess or some other outside force. You're developing powers that are natural to yourself. And that's the secret. And that's not necessarily a religion. In a way, it's closer to what people are doing with like martial arts or a really serious musician. You think of a really serious guitarist who would put again an hour of practice a day. They're trying to develop some of their own potential. Mages, practitioners of magic, are doing exactly the same thing. They're trying to develop their own potential, but to do something a little more complex and a little stranger than playing a guitar or you know doing a good sidekick.
Who is the magician Eliphas Levi?
Eliphas Levi. Eliphas Levi. He's the reason that magic is as popular today as it used to be.
Really? Died in 1875.
He died in born in 1810, died in 1875. He started out as a perfectly ordinary French Roman Catholic kid. Grew up, you know, he was one of these sort of your basic bookworm as a child, and very very religious, very devout. So of course he was aimed at the Catholic priesthood. He went to seminary. He got ordained as a deacon. He started teaching catechism class to a class of young women, and promptly fell in love with one of his students. Decided, okay, I'm not cut out for a celibate lifestyle. Went on to become a writer, got involved in magic. Long, complex story there. But he ended up writing a book. It was published in 1855. I won't give you the French title because I don't pronounce French anywhere near as well as I read it. But it works out to The Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic.
Okay.
And now, 1855, this is in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Their telegraphs are everywhere. Steam-powered trains are everywhere. Everybody's feeling all you know, up-to-date and modern and cutting-edge.
As much as they could be, I guess, huh?
Well, the thing is, we tend to forget just how cutting-edge that felt back in those days.
True.
We think, well, you know, they didn't have computers. No, but they had the telegraph. You could actually like send a message to somebody in Russia and have it get there in minutes. It was stunning back in the day. So, but in the middle of this booming, up to date, advanced, scientific, rational society, Eliphas Levi pops up with this book, Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic, and all of a sudden people are going, whoa, there's more to this than medieval superstition. And it launched the modern magical boom. It's a very good book in its own way. It is well worth reading. It's one of my very recent books. In fact, is a professional translator, Mark Migget.
Was it a how-to book? How to?
Yeah, it's an intro. It's called Doctrine and Ritual. We now say theory and practice. Okay, so the first half is the theory. The second half of the practice, it literally walks you through. Now, it's tricky. Books on magic typically were in those days. They're a lot better now. But you have to read it carefully to figure out what it's saying. Levi was cautious. He didn't want this stuff to be dropping in the hands of just any moron who wanted to open it. So it's not magic for dummies.
Was he an occultist? Think about that.
Yeah.
John, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, Circles of Power, and so much more as we talk about magic. Right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we're going to be back in a moment with John Michael Greer as we talk about his work, Circles of Power, as we talk about magic. Lots more to talk about. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him as well. Welcome back. John Michael Greer with us, Circles of Power. John, let's get back to the magician Levi. And
that's Levi, yeah.
Did he change the face of magic? What did he do?
Oh, very much so. His book, again, this book that I recently translated with Mark Miketuk, just completely revolutionized people's understanding of magic, because everyone had been thinking that it was just, you know, medieval superstition or rabbits in hats.
Mumbo-jumbo.
Yeah, mumbo-jumbo. And he showed that the heart of it is a psychological process. The heart of it is actually working with consciousness, using symbols, using ritual, using all these various tools to get down, basically get underneath the hood of the mind and start working with it in this kind of subtle and very powerful way. And so it was because he wrote that book, because it was published and put into circulation, because people picked it up and said, wow, I can do this stuff, that magic didn't simply wither up and die.
Did he save magic?
Basically, yeah. He's the reason people practice magic today, basically, in the Western world. I mean, the thing is, every society in the world, every society throughout history, throughout the world, has practiced magic. People practice magic in modern America. People practice magic in ancient Egypt. People, I mean, probably, we don't know. The records aren't very good. But I'm sure people, you know, Neanderthals practiced magic back in the day. It's just, it's one of the things human beings do. But Levy was the guy who made it acceptable for intellectuals to get into it, who made it possible for people who had some education, who had some understanding of the way things work, to actually look at magic and say, okay, this is not just mumbo-jumbo, it's not just nonsense, there's something there. And so we have the magical revival we have now.
When you were interpreting his book, anything dramatic in there or something that stood out for you?
It's very much a matter of, okay, what isn't dramatic. One of the things that he pointed out, and this is something I know there's been a certain amount of talk about shapeshifters in the sort of paranormal scene these days.
Yep.
You have all the stuff on werewolves and all things like that. Well, Levy was talking about this, again, back in the 1850s, in a very interesting way, because he pointed out that if you actually read the old legends about werewolves and things like that, it wasn't like Lon Chaney, you know, so this guy suddenly sprouts fur and fangs and runs off, tears off his shirt and runs off into the forest. What would happen is that the werewolf would be lying in bed, completely unconscious, and something would detach itself from him or her and go out, and it was not necessarily, not something that was entirely physical in nature. We're starting to deal with things that are on the edge between the physical and the non-physical, and this is, of course, very much something a lot of people now have trouble with, but if you practice magic, you've got to get used to this kind of thing, because it's an everyday occurrence. You encounter these things. Most people know about astral projection. Okay, out-of-body experience is the common term nowadays. It's something you can learn how to do. Many people, you know, can just buckle down and practice and do certain things, and they'll do it. There's another form of that which magicians call etheric projection, where you're actually putting some of your own life energy into this thing, this projected thing, and it can almost become physical. It becomes physical enough to have effects on physical things. Levy suggested that that's what was going on, that there was actually this organized tradition in the Middle Ages of people who had worked out this trick and would pass it on by initiation. And that's where this whole werewolf thing, it was a wolf cult. It was people, you know, some perhaps dating from very ancient times, people who learned to do this etheric projection thing to extrude their etheric bodies in the form of a wolf.
He dabbled with tarot cards too, didn't he?
He was all over tarot cards. He's half the reason you've heard of tarot cards. He was the guy who showed that tarot cards have, that there's more to them than just fortune telling. He's the one who showed that there's a lot of really deep esoteric philosophy in tarot cards. And so it was because, you know, he wrote about them in great detail. There are 22 chapters in each of the two sections of his book. 22 chapters of theory, 22 chapters of practice, 22 tarot trumps. They're actually tied in.
Was he a good guy?
Yeah, references a trial. He knew what he was doing.
Would you say he was a good person?
The people who knew him, and of course I never met him, he died a long time before I was born. The people who knew him said he was a really sweet man. He was kind, he was gentle, he was very good friends with, he was a very good friend, a very good person to be around. Nobody ever accused him of doing anything obnoxious in his life.
Ironically, he died the year Aleister Crowley was born.
Yeah. And, of course, Crowley, who could not resist pumping himself up this way, insisted that he was Eliphas Levy's reincarnation.
Did he do that?
Yeah, he did.
Well, that's interesting.
The problem is that Eliphas Levy died shortly after Crowley was born, so unless there was some kind of retroactive reincarnation.
Yeah, that's right. They hold back for a little bit.
No, I hope I'm not going to offend any of the Crowley fans among our listeners that Aleister Crowley was overrated. The only reason that anybody's heard about him these days is that Grady McMurtry restarted his order, the Ordo Templi Orientis, back in the 60s. And McMurtry was a really serious occultist. McMurtry was a really gifted man. And so he picked up the smoking ruins that Aleister Crowley left, put them together in a working system, and got all of Crowley's books back in print and so on. But there were dozens of people in Europe, in England, and so on, at the time that Crowley was around, who were considerably more interesting, more important, more significant than Crowley ever dreamed of being.
Was Crowley an evil man, John?
I don't know. He certainly seemed to have been a world-class jerk.
Yeah, I would guess he'd be in a circle of people that they would call a psychic vampire. They wouldn't want anything to do with him.
I don't even know if it would go that far. He just was he treated people really abusively,
and he got away with it.
And got away for a while. You have to remember, Aleister Crowley started out life. He was rich. He was intelligent. He was talented. He was handsome. He had everything handed to it. I mean, he was the heir to a beer brewing fortune. Crowley's Ales were once quite famous in Britain.
Oh.
And by the time he ended his life, he was a burnt-out drug addict in a small-town flophouse with an estate worth 14 shillings, a few bucks, basically, and a name that he himself had made a laughingstock on three continents. You know, if this is the fruit of a life in magic, you are doing it wrong.
Amazing. So what else are you working on these days? You said you've got some other books coming.
Oh, what aren't I working on? I'm kind of drawing a deep breath after the doing the Eliphas Levy translation, because that was a huge project. Mark and I had to do a lot of footnote work, a lot of research into Levy's references and so on. And so we really tried to make the book a massive tome, and one that would really explain itself. Everything footnoted, all the necessary references are there, and I did that, mind you, right after doing the definitive seventh edition of Ezra Regardi's book, The Golden Dawn, which is another major occult work of the 20th century. At this point, again, I'm kind of catching my breath. I'm doing some fiction these days.
Oh, you are?
That was what I originally wanted to write.
Most of your work has been nonfiction.
Almost all of it. I've had four novels published so far. But yeah, I'm doing some fiction these days, but I'm looking toward the next big magical project. I'm not perfectly sure what it's going to be now.
John, when we take calls, I want people to kind of share their magical stories with
you. Please do,
see what we get. How would you define magic in terms of what it does for people, what it can do for people?
It depends very much on how you approach it. It can make your life go a lot smoother. It can mess you over big time. If you approach it with the wrong attitude, it'll do to you what it did to Crowley. Because one of the problems with working with consciousness is it can turn into an echo chamber. And if you approach it with a good attitude, it'll run with that and give you all kinds of good experiences. If you approach it as Crowley did, as a world-class jerk, it's going to whap you in the face over and over again. If you seek the great work as Eliphas Levy taught, if you're trying to get at that core of creation, at that those currents of power and consciousness at the center of the world, then you can go some very, very deep places. But it really, magic is a mirror. It depends what looks out of it depends on who you are, who looks into it.
Can it change your life dramatically?
If it doesn't change your life, you're not doing it right.
Do you practice it?
Oh, yeah. I've been a practitioner of magic since I was a teenager.
Now, do you do it to enhance your career, your life? What do you do it for?
These days I don't really have to do much of it to enhance my career. My career is doing really well.
It's taken off on its own.
It's been chugging along. I do some things. Mostly, a lot of it has to do with astrology, which I also practice.
Okay. How do you tie magic into astrology?
Really simply, use astrological timing for your workings. And this could be really simple. If you watch, for example, the movements of the planets relative to your birth chart, and when something's negatively aspecting your natal Mercury, that's not a good time to submit a book proposal to a publisher. When you have, say, Sun trine Mercury, get that thing in. Ever since I started doing that, my sales have gone way up.
It's ironic that people have been. Whoop, where'd you go? Are you there? Nope, we've lost him. He has magically disappeared. Let's see if I can find him again. If not, we'll get Tommy to call him back. Are you there, John Michael? Nope, he is not there. So let us get him back on. Simply disappeared. Sometimes we're convinced that there are little leprechauns in the phone system doing whatever they do. But we weren't into anything too controversial where they would take him off the air, but you never know. But next hour, we're going to take your phone calls with him as well. We got him back. There you go. See, the power of magic, you disappeared on us. But we've got you back.
Unfortunately, that's the power of a slightly decrepit national telephone system.
Yeah, I think so, too. That's probably what happened. You know, a lot of times, John, they do maintenance in the wee hours because they figure, nobody's on the phone. Little do they know.
People listen to Coast to Coast, yeah. And they'd learn a few things.
They would. They sure would. Okay, so we're talking about how could magic help individuals. How do you do that?
It can change your life. It depends on what your problems are. Normally, most of us, our problems, we carry them with us. People say, "Oh, my problem's out there. It's my job. It's my spouse. It's these people there." No, you carry your problems in yourself. If you change how you approach your life, you will change your life completely. And magic's a really effective way to do that. You can't do it consciously. You see, most people can't just decide, "Oh, I'm going to live differently," because so much of what we do, so much of our behavior, it's unconscious. We don't notice it. We don't think about it. It comes out of our childhood. It comes out of our astrological chart. It comes out of all kinds of things that pass below the surface of consciousness. But when you use magical methods, when you're using rituals, symbolism, things like that, you can tweak it. If in fact you have, you're constantly having love problems, for example, which is one of the things a lot of people really start, they get into magic. Okay, why can't I keep a relationship going? Well, usually it's because you're not a particularly lovable person. And you can go running around trying to browbeat other people into having a relationship with you anyway, but that won't work. Make yourself lovable and people will fall in love with you. Magic allows you to do that. Magic allows you to get in, as I said, get in under the hood of your own psyche, figure out what's wrong, tweak it, and get things moving correctly. So, do you have problems with love? Okay, that's great. Career. I mean, most of the advice that people get in the world from school counselors, from the media, that is not for their benefit. That is for the benefit of their employers. And so people are constantly bashing their heads against brick walls, basically, because they're being told all these things that simply aren't true. You remember a little while ago there was all this stuff about how, well, if you're having trouble getting a job, you should go get an education. So people ran up these huge student loan bills.
And now what?
Education for jobs that didn't exist. And then they're still out of work, and now they have
this debt. $1.
Yeah, exactly. They're way over their heads in debt. That's because the people who were pushing that on them was the university industry who wanted to make money off them. Okay? So to some extent, there's a certain amount of common sense and a certain amount of suspiciousness that needs to go into this. But also, look, how you deal with your career, with your economic life, with the money that comes in, with the money that goes out, you have a lot of control over that. And you may not realize how much control you have. You may be doing things reflexively. You may not be noticing what you're doing. Again, taking a step back, using those magical methods to focus attention on what you're actually doing, and you go, I'm being an idiot. I'm spending all this money on this stuff that doesn't make me happy. And just letting it pile up, to gather dust in the closet. And if I were to not spend that, then I'd start building up this money. I wouldn't have to work that. I wouldn't have to work so many extra hours. I could do this and that instead. The world changes because you change. We really do carry our problems with us, and magic is a great way to deal with that. And then as you start getting control of your problems, you can start saying, okay, what qualities would make my life even better than it is? So it isn't just a matter of patching over the damage. It's a matter of saying, okay, I want to build my creativity. I want to do this other thing. I want to write, let's say. Or I want to become a musician. Okay, great. You can do that. If you're willing to commit the energy, if you're willing to focus and approach it the right way, and magic, again, gives you the power to do that because it allows you to focus your consciousness in a way that gets you past the obstacles and enables you to do things.
Do witches practice magic? Is that what they do?
Depends on the witch. I know a lot of witches. Just one of those things. Some of them practice a lot of magic. Some of them just worship their goddess. And I'd say most witches practice at least some magic. They tend to do a lot of the practical magic stuff that I was talking about. Just, you know, dealing with problems in their own lives, doing some healing here, doing some blessing there, that kind of stuff.
And they're generally pretty good people.
The ones that I've met are just literally the salt of the earth. I have no idea why. Well, I do have one idea why. The fundamentalists get so bad out of shape about witches. Oh, no, they're devil worshippers, blah, blah, blah. I honestly think it's because they don't pay tithes. There's a real financial incentive on the part of a lot of churches these days. See, you know, they don't have a lot of members these. A lot of churches have been losing membership for a long time. They're running short on money. They're going, And so they're trying to pad their budgets by convincing everybody they've got to come to church and hand over the money, or they're going to fry in hell.
Now, if you could use magic for any one thing, what would you use it for right
well,
now?
Well, if I could use it, I am using it.
Well, that's true.
Because, no, seriously, magic is part of my life. As I said, I've been doing this since my teen years. A lot of what I do with magic these days has to do with, I've already worked through a lot of the bugs in my own career and my own relationships and then interpersonal connections and so on. At this point, a lot of what I do has to do with helping other people, teaching them, initiating students into magic and so on. And so, if something occurs to me to do with magic, I've probably already done it, and I'm probably going to be doing more of it too. Oh, and there's one other thing.
Yeah.
There are four basic principles, call them virtues, what have you, and this is from L.F.S. Levy's book also. This is from Doctrine and Ritual of High Magic. To know, to dare, to will, and to keep silent. Those are the things. To know, you got to know what you're doing. To dare, you have to have the courage to act on your knowledge.
That's right.
To will, that's very powerful. If you want to be a mage, you don't spend your time wishing. You don't spend your time wanting. You will. You focus your intention on. You go for it. And then keep silent. Because the more you blabber about something, the more of your energy you waste. Probably everybody who's listening to us right now knows somebody who's going to write a book. And somebody who just talks by the hour about the book they're going to write. They'll never write it until they learn how to keep their mouths shut. Because the more you talk, the less you do. Of course, here I am talking on the radio. So,
but you're talking a lot to a lot of people. John, hold on. We're going to come right back, and we're going to take phone calls with you as we talk about magic and perhaps get some stories on how magic has changed your life.